Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown. Today is Wednesday, September the 13th, and I hope you have positive thoughts up there because it is National Positive Thinking Day. It's also National Bald is Beautiful Day. I don't know if that applies to me. Most people say that it does, but one person that it doesn't apply to is Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
I'm going to think positively today. I am positive that I'm going to be as positive as anyone has ever been.
Well, that's great, Stephen, because we are positive that we have some really great news stories that we're going to be bringing to you. We're going to go ahead and kick those off with an exciting announcement from a startup company. CoreWeave is looking to sell a little bit of itself. Specifically, they're trying to sell a minority stake in the company to raise some funds. The stake sale is going to be for about 10% equity, and it's going to be valued somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 to $8 billion. CoreWeave is backed by NVIDIA and has been seeing some massive growth thanks to generative AI workloads. CoreWeave offers a cloud platform specifically geared toward AI development. Stephen, what are your thoughts on CoreWeave offering a stake sale?
Well, I'm going to give you some thoughts on CoreWeave overall, and I think that that'll kind of help fill in the blanks here. So many of our listeners may not be familiar with CoreWeave. You may be like, who's this? What is this story all about? Well, CoreWeave is basically the AWS of AI. In other words, this is the company that is far and away the leading specialist provider of cloud for machine learning processing. The way they got to be that was through a very, very shrewd launch. Basically, they decided to launch a cloud service focused on machine language or machine learning processing. They got NVIDIA involved with a huge investment. And as far as I know, that NVIDIA investment immediately went to buy a bunch of NVIDIA equipment. Now, you've probably heard that NVIDIA equipment is extremely constrained. It's hard to get those things, especially the latest, greatest, best stuff. Well, CoreWeave's got it. And that's their angle, right? And it's a good angle. It was a smart move by the company to basically set themselves up to offer what people can't get. I will mention that there was actually some rumors this week that NVIDIA stuff may not be as hard to get as everybody's let on. NVIDIA says, no, it's really hard to get. Yeah, it's limited. But I think the reason that for those rumors was essentially that NVIDIA is making this stuff as fast as possible. So it's not like it doesn't exist. It's not like nobody's buying, you know, H100s. It's that they're hard to get because everybody's buying H100s. So it's kind of like NVIDIA's latest stuff is hard to get, just like the latest iPhone is going to be hard to get in a couple of weeks, you know? Yeah, they're making a gazillion of them, but they're hard to get just because everybody wants one. And just like that, I mean, imagine if there was a store that had investment from Apple and they always had the latest iPhones in stock, right? That'd be pretty awesome. Well, that's CoreWeave. So what they're doing here is they're basically building themselves up as the go-to place for people who need a bunch of great ML processing and need it now. They've also done some really clever things in terms of building out a ML supercomputer with a partner. NVIDIA, and offering access to that as well. Overall, this story just seems like the next step in a very amazing business case that people are probably going to be studying in the future, because CoreWeave has put themselves in such a great position in this machine learning focused environment. So we'll see where this goes. Yeah, there are naysayers. Yeah, there are people who saying that it's not going to last or whatever. But right now, CoreWeave is where it's at. Tom, networking chip startup Enfabrica has announced a new funding round of $125 million. NVIDIA is joining that too as a strategic investor. Enfabrica is looking to speed up networking connectivity for AI development data centers by combining CXL and RDMA. This means that GPUs can pull data from multiple sources without waiting for the network to catch up, which would increase efficiency and allow for more processing, as well as reduce costs. Now, this is a different use case for CXL. I'm very excited about it, but since it's in the networking realm, tell us a little bit more.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Enfabrica is trying to attack this problem of idle GPUs, because we've seen a lot of companies that are trying to come up with these solutions. If you talk to NVIDIA, they're going to say, oh, well, your solution is to use InfiniBand. because InfiniBand, you know, you can get the data across very, very quickly. And I talked a little bit about that in a recent Conversations episode where I kind of outlined why people use InfiniBand for AI and how networking teams are trying to make Ethernet a little bit more, I don't know, attractive to people that are doing AI workloads. And the biggest problem that companies were trying to solve in that space was the fact that if your data did not get back to the GPUs, you know, get returned to the system fast enough, everything was sitting there idling. And that's a huge problem because, you know, think about it. It's like basically having a Ferrari sitting in your garage. If you're not driving it, what good are you doing with it? And so that's why, as you mentioned in the previous story, that NVIDIA stuff is hard to find. Well, if you can get a hold of it, you want to be running it as much as possible, whether it's from any manufacturer. So what Infabrica is trying to do is they're trying to take some of the benefits of CXL, where you're effectively blowing up the construct of what a server looks like and creating these hyper-fast lanes to allow data to get pushed around very, very quickly. And they're doing that on a network scale so that these GPUs can fetch data. I believe the article that we linked to from Reuters says, you know, it's basically making it look like a hub and spoke, which is great because it means that the GPUs or whatever you need to send the data to can pull data as quickly as possible without really waiting on the network. And I think that's going to provide a huge value for people that are just sitting there looking at their costs ticking up while they're waiting on this data to either be delivered to the endpoints or be returned from the endpoints. And in a way, they're kind of taking CXL, which has this very valuable way of looking at interconnects, and they're using RDMA on top of it, which is a very efficient transport protocol for getting the data directly into the memory of a GPU to do processing on it. So I'm interested to see what the uptake is going to be on this. I think that there's going to be a lot of discussion between, you know, InfiniBand, Ethernet, and then where Infabrica is going to land in the middle. And obviously, someone's going to win out. The question's going to be, is it going to be the old incumbent? Is it going to be the hot new startup? Or is it going to be some people who are in the more traditional networking space trying to rev Ethernet one more time to make it relevant to what we're trying to accomplish? All right, Stephen, we forgot to mention that it's one other very important day. It's MLPerf Benchmark Results Day. That's right. Put on your party hats because MLPerf Inference 3.1 has a new front runner. NVIDIA unleashed the Grace Hopper GH200 on the benchmark and just let it run wild. On average, GH200 was about 9% faster than the competition. And the combination of running a CPU and a GPU on the same die really seems to be paying off for NVIDIA. There were also some very interesting results from Intel and from storage as well. Stephen, you've been someone who's very hooked into what MLPerf is doing, and you love seeing these results. So give us your take on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And first off, I'm not going to be able to do this justice. There's going to be a lot of coverage of MLPerf every time it comes out. ML Commons does such a great job here. They've brought together the industry in a wonderful way, and it is very impressive what's happening out there. So let's start with inferencing and NVIDIA, like you mentioned. So again, this is not the training tasks. This is inferencing. This is actually using hardware to do ML tasks. And at that, guess what? King of the Hill, Grace Hopper, is still King of the Hill. And in fact, Grace Hopper actually outperforms Hopper in that environment. So it shows that NVIDIA's superchip approach that combines the NVIDIA Hopper GPU and the Grace CPU on the same module actually delivers results to the tune of about 17% better than just using the same GPU alone. So that's cool, absolutely very cool. You know, NVIDIA's, as I said, their stuff is still really, really strong. But as you mentioned, there's a lot more here than to go along with. One of the challengers that we've been looking at, of course, is Intel. Their Gaudi 2, which they got with the Habana acquisition, actually is a pretty solid alternative depending on what you're trying to do, because not everybody needs the absolute biggest, baddest, fastest, most expensive, most hard to get equipment. So if you really just want to be able to offer reasonable inferencing performance, Gaudi 2 actually does a pretty good job. It's about the same as H100, and it's probably more available than H100 as well. So basically, you wanna deploy some inferencing tasks. Well, there you go. There's an option. Another thing that we're seeing is Intel's positioning of the Xeon processors for inferencing tasks actually seems to hold some water. Now, there again, don't make a mistake. The Xeon is not competitive with a GPU in ML training or building an ML supercomputer. But again, a lot of this stuff, especially when it comes to inferencing, is just, you know, using things. And you've got to ask yourself a question. If I've got a Xeon CPU, do I want to pair it with a GPU accelerator or not? Now, that's a big choice, and it really changes the bill of materials. It really changes the total costs. The good news is that you can do GPT tasks. That's what they showed here on a Xeon processor, and it'll summarize some paragraphs in a couple of seconds for you. It works. It works fine. And actually, you know what? That's not a bad option. Now, another thing I do want to mention is that for the first time, ML Commons is showing storage performance. That's right. We've got a storage benchmark. We had DDN, Micron, Nutanix, and Weka submit storage to this benchmark. And they performed kind of all over the place. I really need a lot more time to analyze this to decide what it really means. But I will say one thing that it means is kudos to ML Commons and kudos to those companies for participating, for showing the performance of their system, and for basically starting to move forward with a storage benchmark for machine learning tasks, because that's going to be critical, a critical part of the infrastructure going forward. And if we don't have a benchmark, then we can't really know the value of what we're buying, which again goes to the value proposition of ML Commons and MLPerf generally. So good on you. Thank you to those companies for participating. Thank you to ML Commons for developing this. And also, I guess the big takeaway here is when it comes to inferencing, you've got a lot of choices. It doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest, baddest hardware. You got to match what you're doing to, you know, what you're using to what you're doing. And that may end up being a CPU instead of a GPU even. MGM Resorts is smarting from a big hack that happened this week. Attackers were able to call into the help desk and manage to convince one of the employees to grant them access. That's right, social engineering. After that, they were able to get into the gaming network, which shut down gaming machines across the properties in Las Vegas and Atlantic City. They also invaded the door lock system, taking control of 46,000 hotel doors. The ALPHV group, I guess maybe you know how to say that, has taken responsibility for the attack. Kind of embarrassing.
It was very embarrassing for them. We saw a notification go out sometime on Monday morning saying that MGM Resorts had been the victim of a cybercrime attack and they had shut down their systems and they were trying to figure out what was going on, but it was too little too late. I mean, people were posting pictures of the gaming machines basically being shut down. And if you've ever worked with a casino, you know that they have a minute-by-minute accounting of how much it costs for one of those slot machines to be down. They know exactly how much money they're losing, and they shut down a lot of them. That was probably the most embarrassing part of it. And then they found out that they got into the door lock systems too. So could you imagine going to a casino in Vegas and just, oh, all of a sudden all the slot machines go down. Oh, that's fine. I'll just go back to my room and watch some TV. What do you mean I can't get into my room? The door locks are completely shut down. Yeah, that's the kind of problem that you run into. I thought it was funny that somebody mentioned on Twitter that a $33 billion company was brought down by a 10-minute help desk call. And you would think that the Nevada Gaming Commission would require that the gaming network almost be air-gapped from the rest of the system. Boy, you'd think that, wouldn't you? I think there's going to be a lot of very hard questions that MGM is going to have to answer. I think that a lot of people at MGM are probably going to lose their jobs because this is something that should not have happened. I mean, we've seen it before. Caesars was impacted by some issues last week. Some other companies are, you know, saying that they're being hacked. And I think part of it is coming down to the fact that reporting structure is changing from the SEC. But more importantly, when a company like, I don't know, like Siemens gets hacked, that's boats on the ocean. We don't see that. But man, when a slot machine in Vegas starts going haywire, there's lots of pictures and video of that. So they had to address it quickly, and they're still trying to do the postmortem. I'm assuming that they've ejected the attackers by now, one would hope. But we won't know for sure until we get the full postmortem, and let's just hope they're being honest with themselves and with us to prevent this from happening in the future. And if not, I'll put a bet out for it with you. All right, Intel has a big announcement. They have increased the power of Thunderbolt. Thunderbolt 5 was released. This version offers 80 gigabits of bidirectional throughput per second, and it has bursting capabilities that will take it all the way to 120 gigabits per second. The underlying technology is built on USB 4 version 2, which means that it has double the PCI Express data throughput, and it brings the standards that are supported by Thunderbolt 5 up to their latest versions, you know, things like DisplayPort and HDMI and that, so on and so forth. Stephen, Thunderbolt is one of those technologies that we've really kind of watched grow over the years, and it has a lot of exciting implications for the future. You know, what's got you excited about this announcement?
Well, honestly, Thunderbolt 5 is an incremental upgrade over Thunderbolt 3 and 4. So let's not be, you know, weird about this. Most users are probably not going to notice much in terms of an upgrade. It's not like you're going to rush out and buy new Thunderbolt 5 stuff, especially because you're not going to actually be able to use this for a while. The spec is here, but I don't expect devices that support this to come out for at least a few months, if not a year. But that being said, it's a nice upgrade, and it will give a lot of better capability in some key areas that I think users are excited about. Now, again, we're not a consumer tech site, and we don't really cover that. So I'm going to start focus mostly on the kind of nuts and bolts under the hood kind of things. So the big thing that Thunderbolt 5 is bringing is PCI Express Gen 4. That gives us more bandwidth. It also gives us PAM signaling, which is a big advancement there in terms of throughput. And essentially, it gives Thunderbolt the kind of capability that you'll find in the latest CPUs that are coming out now in terms of PCIe 4. You know, another thing is that it's a little bit more flexible. You know, it's got a lot more bandwidth, which is great because you can attach, you know, more monitors, get more performance from things. But it's a little bit more flexible in that it can reverse one of those PCIe lanes, so you can get up to 120 gigabits of outbound bandwidth for connecting to high-res monitors and things like that. And again, not being a consumer blog, we're going to talk about enterprise implications here. That's the sort of thing I think that we're going to start seeing in servers going forward as well. If they've done it in Thunderbolt 5, why not do that in other areas? So to bring this back to an enterprise focus, CXL, for example, runs over PCI Express. As CXL gains traction, I think that it's very likely that we'll start seeing CPUs supporting this sort of dynamic reallocation of PCI Express lanes in a big way. And I wouldn't be surprised if the same kind of concept applies to servers that are using CXL-based memory, for example, or the next generation server CPUs that are trying to maximize the number of PCIe lanes to support external CXL devices. Dynamic reconfiguration of PCIe lanes would really help that, because you could, for example, say, you know, hey, I don't have any expansion slots in this. I want to use everything for CXL so that I can access more memory at higher bandwidth. I think that would be very, very smart. And I think that that's sort of the direction that we're looking here. Now, I don't have any insider information there, but I would say that Intel is showing us where they want to go with PCI Express through Thunderbolt. And you know, finally, I would say Thunderbolt is my go-to analogy when I start talking about CXL, because as soon as I talk about it, everybody's eyes sort of glaze over and they're like PCIe, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wait. You know, when you have a Mac and you plug a thing into that port and you can put a GPU in an external box, or you can have an NVMe SSD that you can access at full speed, or you can have, you know, a docking station with all sorts of functions and it's connecting over PCI Express instead of over, you know, USB. That's kind of an analogy for CXL. And to show that Thunderbolt is advancing, to have this technology be available in more and more devices, is just going to help us all to understand that PCIe is not just an inside-the-box protocol. It's an outside-the-box protocol, whether it's Thunderbolt for consumer devices or CXL for enterprise devices. And, you know, you can take that to the bank. It shows that this technology really works.
All right, Stephen, we had a story we wanted to take a closer look at, and it's one that kind of hits on both of our topic areas. And it's kind of interesting because there was an excellent article that was published by a man named Kareem Khan, and he is currently a prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. And he has started to make the case that cyber criminals should be subject to international law for the escapades. The current state of the world often sees a lot of these cyber criminals go unpunished because they're either backed by nation states or there's just a plain old lack of jurisdiction. Khan says that we need to really get tougher by ensuring that these ne'er-do-wells can face justice for their crimes, especially considering the fact that they've impacted so many people around the world, and they've started to hit softer targets. They're not just attacking shipping companies or other places like that. They're starting to go after places like hospitals. And I know that we both have pretty strong opinions about this, but I wanted to kind of start off this discussion first by asking, you know, we've seen a lot of the cyber criminals that are starting these gangs. They're basically headquartered in less friendly countries to the West, and they seem to basically get away with impunity. Do you think that Karim Khan can actually get things changed so that these criminals can be extradited to the International Criminal Court to face justice?
Well, I think that this is right. And I would say that this really kind of went under the radar. I really appreciate some of the folks in the community who pointed out this article to me. And because in reading it, honestly, I wouldn't have even noticed this until somebody else put it in context. So let's do that. As you said, that this is a prosecutor for the International Criminal Court. These are the people who prosecute war crimes. And one of the things that he says in the article, I'm actually going to read it here because I think it's the key thing to understand about what he's trying to say. He says there's an emerging consensus among states that cyberspace is not a special domain free from regulation, but rather that international law has a clear role to play. That's the summary of this whole argument. He's not saying that we need a new law about cyberspace. He's not saying that we need some kind of international treaty that says cyberspace is or is not a place where we should be looking for war crimes and human rights abuses. He's saying that cyberspace is not a special place. Cyberspace is just another field in which people can commit human rights violations and war crimes. And to have a prosecutor say this, what he's clearly indicating is I'm going after people who commit war crimes in cyberspace, just like I would people who commit those crimes in physical domains. And I feel like that right there is getting us where we need to go as a society. Because if you look at what has happened, now, admittedly, you know, the cyber crimes that have happened in, for example, Ukraine or in the West with international, you know, conflict, or frankly, in countries in that you know, the West is attacking, many of those things have gone unnoticed or unobserved. But I think that we could make a case that some of those were crimes against you know, human rights in the strictest sense. If you're attacking a hospital and taking down their ability to help heal patients, that's a crime, according to the International Criminal Court, and you should be prosecuted for that. Just because you did it behind a keyboard instead of at a missile battery doesn't change that. So on that point, I think that maybe, I don't want to say we can all agree, but I think that many of us can agree that cyberspace, like he says here, is not a special place and that the crimes committed there should be prosecuted by the International Court. Now, Tom, if we take that as a given, where does this go next?
Well, I think where it goes next is we're going to have to kind of rearrange the law that we have to help be more specific about these problems. In the article, he mentions that the International Red Cross has already put out statements talking about how just because something is, you know, I don't know, like a power plant attached to the internet doesn't mean you should treat it like a computer system. You should treat it like what it is. And you know, the International Red Cross, the Geneva Conventions Against Warfare exist for a reason, because we don't make war on civilian populations. That's just wrong. I think almost all of us would agree that wiping out a hospital or breaching a dam and causing a flood that you know, destroys thousands of acres and kills thousands of people is bad. But it's hard to put those two things together when in the old days, we've literally had to wire the dam. And today, all I have to do is punch a few keystrokes and all of a sudden, some things on a board change and you don't see that impact. And I think that it's going to take organizations like, you know, Amnesty International and the International Red Cross to help people understand the importance of that. And I go back to the Stuxnet hack. We, you know, it's one of the most famous hacks that was pulled off by intelligence agencies, but it was very specifically targeted in such a way as to not cause collateral damage. They didn't blow up a nuclear power plant. They wrecked the equipment inside of it so that it couldn't operate, and did it in a way that would take the plant completely offline. And that was essentially the morality of an intelligence service going, I don't want to cause a disaster, but some people are not that good. Some people are not that moral or ethical or empathetic. And could you imagine what would happen if we wanted to knock out power to a country that we were about to invade? So we literally caused a nuclear disaster to get there. Two for one, baby. I knock out the power and I deny that area to people. And that kind of thinking is what's going to lead us down this slippery slope. How long will it be before a country just literally has all of its hospitals shut down so that they can't care for wounded troops? And if you are all connected to the internet, which we are now, that's a huge problem. And we've seen this uptick in the way that cyber warfare is being conducted. And just like we would run into a situation where enemy intelligence agents or spies put on civilian clothes and try to blend into the population, we have non-military actors that are trying to carry out operations on behalf of the military and then claim innocence because I'm not a combatant. And I think that that's going to get into a very, very deep gray area, which is why we have to go back and we have to redefine what this means. I know that you and I have taken a look at the U.S. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act on a number of occasions and kind of, you know, turned up our noses to it because it was written in a time when War Games was the most advanced computer system that we had ever seen. But we still have to have laws. And for all of the crypto bros out there that are watching us say, oh, cyberspace is a different place and, you know, it's not subject to the laws of man, you still have to interact with daily society. We are not to the point where it's like the lawnmower man and you can upload your consciousness into cyberspace and live there forever. We still have to have reality grounded with everything that we do. And reality is governed by laws written by people to make sure that we as a society behave in a way that comports for ourselves to grow. And if that means that we have to say to all the countries of the world, it's time for us to grow up and act like adults and start prosecuting the people who are doing these things, not for the lulls, not for the money, but for the chaos, then I think that's what we need to do.
And I would say that it's important to keep in mind, though, that the International Criminal Court has been somewhat controversial among nations. And it's important to realize that when it comes to cybercrime, most of the countries that are most guilty of cyber attacks against each other are not signatories to the International Criminal Court or members. So Israel, the United States, and Russia all signed on, but then withdrew their signature over, you know, in between 2002 and 2016. India and China never were signatories or members and have not become part of this. Again, I'm not trying to throw shade on any of those countries in particular, but I will say that if you were to make a list of who you're going to worry about when it comes to cyber warfare, I think that those would be some of the countries that would be on your list. And none of them are allowing themselves to be subject to this. But that being said, I think that this sends a message. So to have the prosecutor, again, he's not just a prosecutor, he's the prosecutor, say, I'm going to go after these crimes in the International Criminal Court, it sends a message to countries, even countries that are not signatories, that we shouldn't consider cyberspace to be something that is not subject to international law and human rights considerations. And I hope that that would send a message to countries, even those countries that are not signatories, that they ought to maybe start paying attention to international law and not endanger everybody. Because, you know, as we've seen in story after story here on the Rundown, it is very easy to cause havoc with a cyber attack. Malware, social engineering, viruses and worms and bots, they can cause incredible damage, in many cases more damage than, you know, somebody pulling the trigger of a gun or setting off a bomb or launching an artillery round. And we need to have some way of controlling that.
Well, I know it's a little bit of a heady subject matter, but remember that this is National Positive Thoughts Day. And we have some very positive thoughts coming your way very shortly, because we have great field day events coming up that you're going to want to check out. Hey, Stephen, where are you going to be next week?
Well, it looks like I'm going to California, and I will be attending the SNEA Storage Developer Conference next week. Part of that is Storage Field Day. So we're partnering with our friends from SNEA for Storage Field Day. And so we are going to have delegates attending the Storage Developer Conference, by the way. If you'd like to attend, I think that you can still get a pass. Go to storagedeveloper.org. Tune in remotely. You can find us on LinkedIn or our website on Wednesday and Thursday for presentations. We're going to get an update from Cetera. We've got a product announcement, something new coming from Solidigm on Wednesday. So tune in at 11 for that. And then on Thursday, we're going to have a couple of SNEA presentations, including DNA storage. That's right, storage on DNA. And then we got more stuff coming.
All right. And we have some exciting things coming up, such as Edge Field Day, which will be taking place October 4th and 5th. That's something that a lot of people are very excited about. I hear that Edge is a hot new technology. We've talked about it quite a bit, as have you on the Utilizing Edge podcast. If you are not subscribed to that, you totally should go check it out. Don't forget that you can catch us every Wednesday around 12:30 Eastern time with another great episode of The Rundown. Whether it's myself and Stephen, or Stephen and a co-host, or me and a co-host, we have all of the news that is exciting to you in enterprise tech. You can consume the show through our YouTube channel, youtube.com/GestaltITVideo. If you want to check up on the show notes and see some of the articles that we've pulled some of our information from, we always have those on gestaltit.com. And don't forget that we publish this episode of podcast. So if you want to listen to it while you're out for a run, now that the weather's starting to cool off, or maybe mowing the yard, we want to give you the information however we can get it to you. And if you have any news stories for us, please don't hesitate to let us know. As Stephen wanders off to find more great stories, we want to make sure that you are tuning in, and we love your comments, we love your analysis, and we love to hear that the community gets their news straight from us, because we like to make it fun and educate a little bit at the same time. We'll be back next week with another great episode, 12:30 Eastern time. Make sure you set your calendars, and until then, stay safe, take care, and we will see you soon.